WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Okay, I wanted to do the opening reading.
Okay. There were at least three kinds of cops in Harvard Yard, a scattering of Cambridge cops, gray-haired mostly, with faces out of County Mayo, portly old men in brown uniforms and no sidearms who guarded the gates, and squadrons of Harvard University police who wore tailored blue uniforms and expensive black gun belts and looked like graduates of the Los Angeles Police Academy. It was Harvard commencement, and if the wasps began to run amok, Harvard was ready. I was ready, too. I had a Smith & Wesson Chief Special clipped onto my belt just back of my right pants pocket where the butt caused only a modest break in the line of my silk tweed jacket. The jacket was off-white with a faint blue weave and came from Brooks Brothers. It wasn't my favorite, but the choices are not wide and off-the-rack size 48s.
What are the important things to get into an opening paragraph in a detective novel?
Well, I don't know that I would distinguish between the important things in a detective novel and the important things in another kind of novel. And the important things will vary with each novel depending on what it is you want to say. In the kind of novel that Valediction is, we are dealing with first-person narration, and therefore you have some things you have to get stated. People want to know who the I is, and people want to know a little bit about where the I is. And so the I in this narration has to identify where he is and a little bit about who he is. And that's what I tried to do in the opening page of Valediction.
Before you started writing your Spencer novels, you obviously read a lot of detective novels, and I know you wrote a dissertation on the novels of Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, and Ross MacDonald. What made you such an avid reader of that genre?
I haven't any idea. Probably some deep-rooted pathology, which I've yet to synthesize, but I am interested and have always been, for whatever reasons, in the nature of heroism and, in particular, the nature of the American hero. I read Chandler from the time I was about 14 when he was publishing, and I read him because I very much liked him. It is retrospective to figure out why I liked him, but it certainly has to do with the nature of the hero and perhaps a little bit of an interest in autonomy. Private eyes and the kind of thing that Chandler wrote are, after all, autonomous. They are beyond the things that motivate you and me, fear of death, greed for money, sex, love, whatever. And Marlowe was in some ways beyond all of those things, though he paid a very high price in his isolation for achieving those things.
Detective novels and films are really associated with America. It's very American genre, and mm-hmm. Europeans have really tried to copy it and make it their own. What do you think it's a form that's been developed here? What makes it American?
Well, there are two kinds of detective stories. There is a kind which began in Europe with Sherlock Holmes and all of that, the so-called ratiocinate detective story, the detective story which assumes that right will out and the detective will prevail because he is of superior intelligence. And it also presumes a rational universe where crime is a deviation from the norm and the detective's job is to restore order. The American version of the detective story does not assume a rational universe. Indeed, it assumes that disorder is the norm, that crime is probably the standard. The detective rarely restores order. At best, probably what he does is maintain his own integrity, and beyond that, maybe he helps somebody else do so. The interest in the American form, I think, reflects people's uneasy sense that we are, ever since the end of World War I, in something somebody unkindly called the post-Christian age, and that the center probably will not hold. And it may not hold at all pretty soon. And in a world in which happenstance is largely random, in which there is no sense of order and continuity in the way things ought to be, we tend to turn our attention to a figure who can function in such a world. And the American kind of detective perhaps is that.
Is it that that chaos, that disorder, that makes it important for that detective to have a code like Spencer has?
I think so. It is the thing that keeps you from kicking around like a grasshopper on a hot afternoon. It is, I suppose, Hemingway is the most visible articulator of that attitude about 20th century life, in which, since there are no absolute rules, the belief in God, the belief in country, all of that for at least a fair segment of the human species seems no longer available. It is necessary, therefore, to impose a kind of arbitrary system by which you can live, since it seems that human beings can't function without some kind of system. And so the Hemingway Code is the most blatant one. I suppose you could sum it up in the image of the bullfighter who does a very difficult task to no good purpose. I mean, if you want a dead bull, there's easier ways to do it than with a sword out with the bull. But he does it because that's what he does. And so he sticks to a kind of system of values rooted in an aimless and very violent system. And the violence, the danger, the threat of death lends it seriousness. Otherwise, it becomes trivial. Since there is no authenticating other source, there's no established church that says this is the right way. There's no biblical source for saying this is God's will. For people like that, if you have a code of behavior and you stick to it in the face of death, then whether it's right or wrong, at least you're serious. And that is, I think, sort of the authenticating experience.
Can you describe the code that you've given Spencer?
No.
Okay.
I can probably, but I won't. In a real sense, the books are the description of the code I've given to Spencer. And there is nothing much more tiresome than authors standing around explaining what their books meant to say. The books are there.
Okay. And the books we're talking about are the novels by Robert Parker, the latest of which is called Valediction. And it, too, features his hero Spencer, who is a detective. Now, you had read all these other detective novels before starting to write your own. Were you very self-conscious then about what the conventions of the American detective genre were?
Probably more at the beginning than I am now. When I wrote the Godwolf manuscript, which is the first novel that I wrote, which is still currently kicking around in paperback, please buy it. I have a kid in college. The question in my mind was frequently answered by, you know, what shall I do? The question, the answer, well, what did Chandler do? How would Marlowe have dealt with this? For reasons partly having to do with success, that is, when the first novel is published and they want your second one, you begin to be less uneasy about what you're doing. And as time goes on, your confidence builds. I have moved the long distance from Chandler and from Marlowe. And I do not think even momentarily about the conventions of the form or about anything else. The idea of form, of there being a kind of form for the kind of novel I write, is useful, and I don't mean it in any denigrating way, to booksellers, reviewers, interviewers, critics, libraries. But it's of no great value to me. The process I go through is the same process Faulkner goes through or went through, the difference being that Faulkner did it better, you know, and came out with something different. I mean, Faulkner's a genius and I'm not. But what we set out to do when we sit down in the morning to write our five pages is probably about the same thing. The difference is, as I say, not an intention.
What are some of the traits that Spencer, who is a modern man, has that earlier detectives didn't or couldn't because of the times?
Well, I don't know whether they could or couldn't because of the times. I suspect the limitations on both Marlowe and on the heroes in Hammett's novels were rooted probably in the limitations in Chandler and in Hammett rather than what the times would permit. There were things, as Raymond Chandler said about Hammett, there were things Hammett either could not say or felt no need for saying, and that Hammett lacked the sound of music from beyond a distant hill. Chandler implies that Chandler had that sound, and I think he's right. I think he did. I think I do too. What obviously I am writing about in a way that no other of the novelists with whom I'm usually compared has done is I'm writing about love. More and more the novels are about love. And about relationship and about love between men and women, love between adults and children. And less and less are they the solution to formal mysteries. That produces two rather extreme reactions. At the one hand, the kind of reaction which says Parker confirms his classic status in this wonderful book, and on the other, a yearning for the old simple pulp line that was in the Godwolf manuscript. And as an interviewer said to me in Cleveland last week, how come Spencer's such a wimp with women? So, I mean, you get classic status on the one hand and Wimp with Women on the other hand. It's one of the reasons I don't read reviews too often.
Well, he has a long-term lover who who is like he, a protagonist in all your novels. Now, I think usually detectives like live alone in this world of chaos, and that gives them the opportunity in each new novel to fall for the client they've undertaken some chase for. And then part of the theme is always, you know, is this client someone who's doing them dirty and actually using them? Will he be deceived or is he falling for the real thing? And will it work, or will she get killed at the end or whatever? Why have you chosen the long-term relationship over that loner status?
It's probably not a choice. I'm not sure there are all that many choices in the production of fiction. Interviews require you to act as if there were, because otherwise you can't talk about it. Almost anything I say about the process of creating a novel distorts the process. There's no way around it. It's like observing an electron. You know, the observation distorts the electron's movement. I have had a long-term relationship, and long-term relationships are what I understand. And what seemed to me the most suitable thing in the world. Somebody asked Freud once, what are the most important things in human life? And he said, love and work. I agree with that. Imagine he'll be pleased to hear that. And I agree with that in about that order. And it is what Spencer's interests are. You lose the opportunities that you described, but you gain opportunities which I think are more valuable, in that you can talk about relationships and you can observe them in evolution, and you can take what you know when you're 52 and modify what you thought when you were 42, etc. It gives me, I think of the books in truth as a kind of ongoing story rather than one, and they're in collection, they're a kind of a saga, and they reflect the process of creation over 10, 12 years. And I know things now I didn't know then, and so the books change. I have grown children now that have taught me much more than they ever taught them. And, you know, I know about that, and I put that in the books.
Her name is Susan Silverman, the lover's name in the book. And it's a very plain name, a Jewish name. That must have been conscious. You could have given her a much more exotic name and made her, given her a different
ethnic. Terry Gross was one of my choices, but I...
Well, I don't mean that exotic, you know. A name everybody yearns for. But why'd you go with the plain name?
I don't really know. I wanted her to be Jewish as a little gesture of ecumenism, just as I wanted Hawk to be black. It's an attempt to suggest that relationships can exceed the limitations of that are normally placed on them. Beyond that, why Susan Silverman? I don't know. I don't like to admit that, but I haven't any idea.
Okay.
That question was too hard for me.
My guest is Robert Parker. Have you done any research with private detectives or with cops about what their real life is on that you could use as source material for your detective novels?
No. I make that stuff all up. And this is, after all, a literary form. I was on an ABC program called Last Word, which canceled right after I was on it, so be careful, Terry, with a Boston private detective named Gil Lewis, about whom a man named Judge Sedgwick has written a book, and with Stephen Cannell, who's the producer of the Rockford Files and other such things. Cannell was in L.A., and I was in Boston, and Lewis was in New York in the studio. And the premise of the program was fictional private eyes are not like real private eyes, to which we all three agreed at once. And then we had an hour to fill, and the host went out of his skull, I think, trying to come up with things to say. I have real private detectives very often probably don't do any of the things that Spencer does, and certainly they don't do them regularly once a year. Real private detectives often do things that are very boring and tiresome, and spend a lot of time doing divorce work, which in Massachusetts includes getting a picture of the darkened window, because in Massachusetts adultery cannot be demonstrated until lights are turned out in the bedroom. Massachusetts is a little slower than some people in recognizing contemporary mores, but all you can do is leave the lights on, friends, and you never get nailed for adultery in Massachusetts. Well, that makes for lousy books. I am writing about a figure of romance. I am attempting to work in some mythic elements from both American and Western culture. That's right, they're not like Private Eyes. On the other hand, I have met a number of cops who tell me that whether or not I've got the details right, I've got the essence right. I know a cop in Boston who's on the organized crime squad named Frank Dewan, and he used to be on the vice squad. And I was talking to him one day at a wedding. I don't know him well. I've met him a few times. We played a little softball together. And I said, now tell me, isn't it a kind of a game? And he said, oh, yeah. He said, you've got it just right. It's a kind of game. He said, we were doing a drug raid one day, and we hit on the bulletproof vests and the shotguns, and we'd bash it down the door with sledgehammers. And it's fun as hell. And you know, most of the time, nobody gets hurt. And it's a kind of grown-up cops and robbers. Well, I know that. I've been in the Army. I've been on athletic teams. I've hung around locker rooms. I know about the certain kind of men and groups. I was in the Army in Korea with a sergeant first class who contended that the most fun in the world was a firefight if you didn't get killed. And that there's some merit to that, particularly if you're the kind of guy he was. There was a great deal of excitement in it. You know, Winston Churchill's line, the most exciting thing in the world is to be shot upon, fired upon without result. Sure, I understand those kind of guys. I understand male bonding. I understand what I will call, for better lack of a better term, jock humor. And cops are like that. I'm pretty sure of that. But I never knew either Private Eyes or cops before I wrote the series. I've met them afterwards. The regional manager of the Pinkerton Detective Agency in Boston wrote me a letter and said, you know, I had it just right. Some people say yes, some people say no, but I think they're talking about different things. Obviously, the life Spencer leads is not typical of the life, say, that Gil Lewis leads, who's an actual private eye. But I think the people who say I've got it just right mean that I've got the essence of it right, that the kind of people and the kind of attitudes that are intrinsic to that are probably right, and I'll settle for that.
Part of that is being a loner, though, isn't it?
Part
of getting it right. I'm thinking of like Gil Lewis, having heard an interview with him, that he really sounded like a loner, like someone who observes everything but isn't in the middle of anything.
Well, I think probably that's true of Lewis, though I don't know him terribly well. I've got to tell a brief anecdote about that before I answer your question, which I will do, or cleverly avoid it, whichever comes first. But Lewis and I were on this program, and the major – we beat to death the point that Private Eyes in real life aren't like Private Eyes in fiction. And then we went our separate ways, and about 3 days later, a woman wrote me a letter who had seen this program and asked me to do some private eye work for her. And I sent the thing on to Lewis and said, so much for reality. You know? I imagine Gil is probably a loner, and I imagine that there are people who do that kind of work because they like being alone. Spencer has a context. Spencer has friends. He has a kind of surrogate son. He has a permanent relationship with an interesting woman. He has friends at the Harbor Health Club, friends in the Boston Police Force, and they're around, and they've been around for 8-10 books. He is not a loner, though he is in quest of autonomy, but that's different.
I think one of the conventions in many detective novels is that the cops and the private eyes are at odds with each other. Is that usually true in your stories as well?
Well, no. It is neither. They're neither at odds nor not at odds. They are after different things. Spencer has the luxury and the liberty to be after justice. Police are just trying to keep things from getting worse. The two goals do not always coincide. If you're going to be a cop, you have to work within a system of regulations. If you're going to be somebody like Knight Errant Spencer, you don't. And so that they are able to achieve different things. But I don't think they're at odds.
My guest is novelist Robert Parker. His latest book is called Valediction. You taught a course when you were teaching college on the novel of violence.
Yes, not my name for the course, by the way.
Oh, okay.
That was the name of the course, but I didn't name it.
Do you have different standards for the degree of explicitness and violence when you're reading a book or watching a movie?
I don't have any standards for explicitness in violence or in sex. I think one does what one needs to do. That doesn't mean, therefore, I have to like it. If someone has done it right and I don't like it, I don't like it. But the point about sex, violence, or whatever is simply that you do what you need to do to get this thing to work. And to get it right and to make this aesthetic artifact as good as it can be. So that my mother, who was always embarrassed by the fact that some of my characters use foul language, assumes I put that in there to sell books. My mother has a rather narrow view of the book-buying public, perhaps, but of course I don't. They speak as they would be expected to speak, no more nor less. I do not enjoy the graphic presentation of violence or, for that matter, of sex for its own sake. And I would like to have as little graphic violence and sexuality as I can get in the movies. And there are movies which I have departed because there was too much of either. The violence bothers me more than the sex, if the truth be known. But anyway, I should think it would ought to bother anyone more than, you know, if you're going to depict something graphic and explicit, it would seem to me better to explicit sex than explicit violence. But it needs to be appropriate to what you're doing.
It must have been a real turning point for you when you decided to leave college teaching and write a novel.
Free at last, Lord God Almighty, free at last.
You didn't like teaching?
No, not at all. I didn't mind the students as much as I minded the colleagues, who by and large seemed to me some of the least admirable people I've ever met. They didn't seem to have anything they cared very much about except tenure and promotion. And not only did they care that they got tenure, they cared that you didn't. It's not sufficient that I succeed. It's important that my friends fail. Could have been written about many of the academics I have encountered. It didn't seem to be suitable employment for a grown man. And as soon as I found something else to do, I did it.
Were you surprised that you actually succeeded in writing novels? Many people would like to do that and try and fail or don't even bother to try, figuring that the odds are really against them.
Well, they're not so bad odds. Interestingly enough, once I published the first novel, about 8 people I know took up the task. You know, if he can do it, good heavens. It is a source of some pleasure to me that they failed. Actually, one of my friends succeeded. Anyway, no, I expected, I always knew I could do this, and I always assumed that I could do it once I found a way to get the time to do it. And I was 40 when I found a way to get the time to do it. And then I did it, and I expected that it would be published, and I expected that it would do well. I mean, I don't – it is sort of wonderful to have done, you know. I mean, why me? Why was I able to do this? Because I'm swell. But yeah, one never gets over that sense of, ooh, I really did it, didn't I? But I, at the other level, I always thought I could, and I'm not surprised that I did in that sense. Both. It's not that hard to do. Publishers are dying to have novels. I mean, they don't write novels. They got to buy them from somebody, and they're as eager to find a writer as writers are to find a publisher. If one can do it, one should. The standard question is, how do I get into writing fiction? And the standard answer, and it's true, is you write it and you send it in. There isn't any other way. And if it's good enough for them to think they can sell it and make a profit, they will. If they don't, they won't.
Do you still read a lot?
I find it much more difficult to read than I used to before I started doing this. I read some. I read Elmore Leonard whenever I can. I read George Higgins. I read Jim Harrison. And then I tend to read Faulkner and reread Fitzgerald and that sort of thing. I was having dinner with a man who's a painter last night, and he asked me the same question. And I said, "Do you look at a lot of other paintings?" He said, "No, I keep seeing the brushstrokes." Well, in a sense, that's what happens to me. It is hard to read because I keep seeing the brushstrokes.
One of your novels is about to be made into a movie. Is it Valediction?
There are several, actually. But Early Autumn has Tom Selleck in the Spencer role, which is supposed to start lensing.
I haven't heard that before, lensing?
Well, that's variety talk. Thesbs to lens in fall. That was supposed to start shooting in the fall. They're still scurrying up a director, but one expects that they will do that in the fall. Wilderness, which is a non-Spencer novel I wrote about 1978 or 9, is supposed to start shooting quite soon now with Richard Dreyfuss in the lead and John Frankenheimer to direct. I have written the screenplay for that. When you say I have written the screenplay, that means I have written some versions of it. Movies have many versions of the screenplay, and the Writers Guild decides who gets screen credit. Last I knew, I still had some with Oliver Stone. Also, there is a television series in the distant offing. We have I'm learning how to talk about this. We have a deal memo at the moment on that. That'll come in a while. We're working with negotiating with networks, but that'll be down the line.
Does Tom Selleck visually remind you of who you had in mind when you
created
Spencer?
He's a winner of the Robert Parker lookalike contest. That's how he got the part. this isn't television, is it? I can get away with that. Sure, he's fine. But the question doesn't really arise. If you are in the book business and I am, and it is a business once it comes out of my typewriter, the last aesthetic judgment on the book gets made when I finish putting the last period on the last sentence. And when I pull that thing off the typewriter roll, then it becomes a product. Prior to that, it is not. But once that happens, it is. And if you're going to sell that product in Los Angeles, then you sell it and you shut up about it. You don't expect that they're going to do it the way you want it done. You don't expect necessarily they're going to do it well. But one of the things they purchased was the right to do what they want with it. And it is no longer mine, just like when you sell a house, you can't complain about the way they decorate it. A Selleck will be fine. The question is really moot. Mute? How about moot? Easy for me to say. The question is moot because movies are so much the product of the director that we'll see what the director makes out of it. I've seen the screenplay by Jay Preston Allen. Jay has written a very good screenplay. Darn it. Wanted to do that, but it's a good screenplay. And John Kelly, who used to be the president of Warners, is the producer, and he knows how to make movies. Selleck is certainly an imposing physical presence and a very popular television star. Whether or not he will be a popular motion picture star, we don't know. And what the director will do with the property when the director gets it and does it is simply beyond anyone's way to know. So it might be great, it might not be, and Selleck might be good, and it might not be. I mean, I just really can't appraise it.
Do you have any favorite movies, or more specifically, detective movies?
Well, one of my problems as a screenwriter is that I really go to the movies, and I'm hanging around Los Angeles saying things like, I really enjoyed Shane, didn't you? I liked a lot of that cinema noir stuff, the old Mitchum movies. Mitchum would have been a great Spencer. He's older, too old now, but he would have been wonderful when he was about 45. He would have been terrific for Spencer. I don't have any strong feelings about the movies. I like Hill Street Blues. I know Betty Thomas on Hill Street Blues, but I don't know the other folks that do it. And it is remarkable in series television that they've been able to maintain that thing as well as they have. But no, I'm not a great movie aficionado, and I don't go a lot, and I don't have a lot of favorites. Dick Powell was a good Marlowe in Murder, My Sweet, about 1946.
Well, I hope your movies work out well and your books as well, too. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.